plays the pivotal role of the choral accompanist. That's here on BBC Radio 3. We're on 90 to 93 FM and on digital radio. It's 1 o'clock now, time for the news with Vaughan Savage.
As the Conservatives gather for their conference in Birmingham, the Prime Minister has confirmed that the government will have to agree more welfare cuts before the next general election. He said the rich must pay their fair share, but ruled out a mansion tax or cuts to pensioners' universal benefits. Mr Cameron also said he was prepared to veto a new budget for the European Union if he considers it too high. The Prime Minister also said that the BBC needed to look into allegations of sexual abuse made against Sir Jimmy Savile. He described the accusations as truly shocking. A number of women have claimed they were abused by him as teenagers, some of them on BBC premises. A special church service has been held in Machynlleth in mid-Wales for the missing five-year-old April Jones, who was abducted in the town 6 days ago. More than 600 people walked in silence from the estate where April lived to St Peter's Church. A 46-year-old local man, Mark Bridger, will appear before magistrates tomorrow charged with her murder. Two people have been arrested after a 12-year-old boy was killed in a hit-and-run accident in Bradford. The boy was on a crossing when he was struck by a car, which moments earlier had sped away after being stopped by police. The Philippine government has reached an agreement with the country's largest Muslim rebel group to end a conflict that has killed more than 120,000 people over 4 decades. A new autonomous region will be created in the southern island of Mindanao, which will give the Muslim population greater political powers. A protest convoy against American drone attacks in Pakistan, led by the Pakistani cricketer turned politician Imran Khan, has reached the borders of the tribal region of South Waziristan. The Pakistani authorities say it won't be allowed any further because of threats by Taliban militants. The weather: a fine dry day for most places, although cloud and some showers could affect the southwest later. Top temperatures: 14 Celsius in southeast England, 11 in northern Scotland. The BBC News and Weather at 1:02.
Playing the piano for me is the best way I know of letting off steam and expressing myself. And in fact, looking back, I'm sure it made me a much nicer teenager for my family to live with.
It doesn't matter at what point in the instrument's history you stop and listen, it still seems quite incredible that hitting a string with a hammer can result in such a kaleidoscope of colour.
Piano Season on BBC Radio 3.
And now, as part of the piano season on the BBC, here's Lucy Skeeping with today's edition of the Early Music Show.
It's generally agreed that one of the more notable entrances onto the stage of musical history happened in the final few years of the 17th century, when a Florentine gentleman, Bartolomeo Cristofori, proudly announced his latest invention, a gravicembalo con piano e forte, he called it. In other words, a harpsichord that was capable of playing both soft and loud. This was the birth of the piano, and by the end of the 1700s, the instrument had reached adolescence, with composers such as J.C. Bach and Clementi in London and Mozart in Vienna absolutely revelling in the new expressive possibilities that this continually improving keyboard instrument had to offer. It had become a crucial means of bringing them and their music before the general public. Later would come the touring piano virtuosi, the technically flamboyant pianist composers who'd make such a huge impression on the early 19th century. But before them, in between, we come across a fascinating and colourful figure, a musician who did a great deal to establish the style and form of the piano concert, and who even got personally involved in the way the instrument itself was constructed. That man, largely forgotten today, is the subject of this early music show. He was from Bohemia, and he was called Jan Ladislav Dusek.
Thank you.
The two movement sonata in B-flat, Opus 24 by Dussek, played on an English Broadwood piano by Riko Fukuda. So who was Jan Ladislav Dussek? Well, as I said, he was born in Bohemia in 1760, the son of gifted musical parents, which makes him just a few years younger than Mozart. After initially studying the organ, he very soon took up the piano as well as the glass harmonica, an instrument very fashionable at the time that involved sort of glass bowls and dripping water, but that's for another programme. And he quickly gained a reputation as a virtuoso on both instruments. The provincial life wasn't for him. He had bigger ideas and he began a career touring all over Europe, which he would continue to do for the rest of his life. Dussek found his way to the Russian court of Catherine the Great, and he might well have settled there, but for an unfortunate incident. Catherine's court was notoriously rife with intrigues and conspiracies, and when Dussek found a ring lying around one day, he put it on his finger. Well, you would, wouldn't you? Little did he realise the consequences. The great Catherine recognised it as belonging to a would-be assassin, and Dussek became embroiled in a known plot to assassinate the Queen. He had no choice but to quickly flee the country.
Thank you.
Dussek's sudden departure from St. Petersburg wouldn't be the only time he had to leave a country in a hurry. Following his time in Russia, Dussek moved on to France, to the court of another great lady, Marie Antoinette. Here, his remarkable ability on the piano and his talent for creating affecting and colourful music made him hugely popular, not least with the Queen herself. He was feted and well rewarded. But these, of course, were dark days in French history. Revolution was looming, and when matters turned ugly for the French aristocracy, Dussek's closeness to the Queen meant that once again he had to make himself scarce and in a hurry. In 1787, he crossed the Channel into England. Dussek used his music to tell the story. When the French Queen was eventually tried and executed, he capitalised on the event by producing a descriptive piano piece he called The Sufferings of the Queen of France. At one point, he even has the piano suggest, with a musical effect, the fall of the guillotine.
La guillotine tombe.
So the piano was Dussek's instrument. He'd made his name playing it and composing for it, and naturally it formed the main part of his output. He was remarkably prolific. There are concertos, sonatas and lots of chamber music. As we've heard, much of it's very virtuosic, but rarely shallow or superficial. On the contrary, he was capable of producing music of great passion and emotional engagement, with often inventive and surprising harmonic progressions. It's been suggested that one of the qualities that the French seemed to enjoy especially was the wistful salon style. And many of Dussek's works reflect this too, seeming to anticipate the music of Schubert and Chopin by almost 30 years.
Thank you.
The final movement from Doucet's Sonata in D, Opus 69, No. 3, known as The Hunt. Once again, it was performed by Riko Fukuda. You're listening to The Early Music Show on BBC Radio 3 with me, Lucy Skeeping. It was in London that Doucet began his relationship with the London piano manufacturer Broadwood, and it would prove an important one for both composer and maker. As Doucet's musical ambitions grew, so he needed a piano that was technically better able to accommodate them. In fact, it was Doucet who first suggested to Broadwood that they increase the compass of the instrument. Doucet loved Broadwood's instruments and insisted on having one with him even when touring on the continent, which not least must have created transport issues in those days. And it was a Broadwood, modelled on Doucet's suggestions, that would famously find its way as a present to Beethoven in Vienna. Another innovation is the idea of playing the piano in recital sideways on to the audience rather than lengthways, which had always been the tradition up to then. Some people said Doucet insisted on this partly because he wanted to better show off his noble profile to the audience. London was certainly a successful period for him, at first at any rate. He found himself a wife. He was now one of the most famous musicians alive, and he ran what appeared to be a flourishing business. But it wasn't to last. He ran up a series of bad debts, and by 1800 was being hounded by his creditors. This was his cue to exit once again, and this time, leaving his wife, he went to Germany. Doucet moved on again, this time to Paris, and it was this that prompted him to compose a magisterial new sonata, which he subtitled The Return to Paris. But it wasn't just his relocation that inspired the piece. At about this time, a contemporary pianist-composer called Joseph Wölfel had created a new work for the piano that he insisted was the most technically demanding piece for the piano ever written. Doucet's return to Paris was his response to this great claim. Like a knight arriving at the scene and throwing down his gauntlet, he really wanted to show everyone just what he and the piano were capable of. And here is part of that piece, the last two movements of the sonata performed by Andreas Steyr. Thank you. the minuet and finale from Dussek's sonata, The Return to Paris, played by Andreas Steyer. The portraits of Dussek that exist from near the end of his life show he was a man of, shall we say, sizable proportions. To put it bluntly, he was obese. He had trouble walking, and in the last years he spent much of his time in bed, although he still managed on occasion to muster himself from his horizontal position between the sheets to appear before his adoring public. But by 1812 he died in Saint-Germain-en-Laye near Paris. We're going to end with one of Dussek's most profound and expressive pieces, the Elegie Harmonique. During his time in Germany, he'd made one of his closest and most important friendships with the Prussian Prince Ferdinand. And when the great man was slain in battle, this piece was Dussek's reaction to the loss of his great friend, and indeed the man who'd been his patron in the early years of the 19th century. We're going to hear the complete sonata to bring us to the end of the programme. It takes as its starting point a passage from Haydn's Four Last Words of the Cross. But here the range of expression takes us far away from the classical world of the 18th century and into the unfettered language of the Romantics.
the Elegie Harmonique by Jan Ladislav Dussek, played by Andreas Steyer. Today's early music show was presented by Lucy Skeeping and produced by Chris Wines. And you can find a downloadable version of that programme on the Radio 3 website. Next weekend, Lucy will be back with two programmes tracing the early history of the piano as part of the piano season on the BBC. And the season continues later in today's edition of The Choir at 5 o'clock, when Alla Jones will be looking at the great tradition of the choral accompanist.
Documentary, drama and music from India on BBC Radio 3 this Sunday night. At 7:45, Radio 3's Sunday feature examines the growing tension between the country's traditional religious life and its rapidly expanding economy.
Anybody who stands up for a higher cause, you know, not for his or her own self-interest, but for something higher than that, immediately strikes a chord in the Indian audience.
In our drama on three, a classic Ibsen play, The Doll's House, is given a new spin by dramatist Tanika Gupta.
Tom says he prefers me in saris. He calls me his little Indian princess.
And at 10:25, music from the north of India in World Roots.
The culture and cultural identity of India. Tonight on BBC Radio 3 from 7:45.
This is BBC Radio 3. The time is just after 2 o'clock. Time now for our Sunday concert presented by Stuart Flinders. It took place last weekend in Manchester at the Bridgewater Hall.
For Bridgewater Reed Bayreuth today, as the BBC Philharmonic and their chief conductor Juanjo Mena give us a concert of music by Wagner. Music from Tannhäuser to start with, and then the German soprano Brigitte Hahn joins the fray with the Wesendonck-lieder before we hear scenes from the final stages of the epic Ring of the Nibelung. In 1842, Wagner buried himself away in the Bohemian mountains and immersed himself in the world of German mythology, ancient stories of medieval chivalry and romance as told by contemporary authors. Before returning home to Dresden, he'd sketched out a scenario for the opera Tannhäuser. He became so absorbed in his subject that he later said he could remember nothing else of any importance about that period in his life. It's the story of two kinds of love, sacred and profane. The sacred, represented in the saintly Elizabeth, the profane by the goddess Venus. Our hero, the minstrel knight Tannhäuser, is in love with Elizabeth, but can't resist the temptations on offer from Venus. When he comes to his senses, he travels to Rome to seek forgiveness from the Pope, but he's refused. Eventually, his soul is saved when Elizabeth dies and intercedes for him in heaven. Tannhäuser was first performed at the Royal Saxon Court Theatre in Dresden in 1845. The leading artists found it tough, one of them telling Wagner, "You're a man of genius, but you write such eccentric stuff that it's impossible to sing." Well, we don't need to trouble ourselves with the difficulties of the vocal parts right now, because we're going to hear the overture beginning with a foretaste of the Pilgrim's Hymn. Applause for guest leader Laura Samuels. And to conduct it with the BBC Philharmonic, here's Juanjo Mena.